But I heard from Dino and from Jack that he does a real nice job. And we were kind of wondering if he was going to make it tonight, and somebody come running in there with a big book under their arm, running like a windmill salesman or a full of brush man, and I figured that must be him. And but he comes from a primary purpose group over in Dallas, and I've heard a lot. I met some people from there, and I've heard a lot of good things about that group, and I don't want to take any more time. So, John, if you'll come up here, let's give my East Side welcome.
I'm not going to sit on it. I'd be way too nervous for that. I'm going to move it to the other side, though. For some reason, it feels better on this side than that side. My name is John Kelly. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September the 4th, 1999, and for that, I am very, very grateful. And I just saw my sainted mother today, and she's pretty grateful, too. She likes that. I sure put that woman through a lot of misery over the years. Some might call me fanatical. I don't know. Some call me a big book dumper. But that's the way I was brought up. I'm not going to tell my story tonight. I'm going to get right into the steps. But I got sober in September of 1999, and that wasn't my first go-round in this rodeo. I started trying to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 1988. And I've been to literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of meetings all over the state of Texas, all over this great country and the Caribbean. Got piles and piles of desire chips. And in the last 5, 6, 7 years of my drinking, I did not want to drink anymore. Did not. I didn't want to go to jail anymore. I didn't want to lose any more friends, lose any more jobs, lose any more freedom, lose any more of my dignity. And I had no iota what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. See, I'm one of these cats that's pretty hip, slick, and cool. You get me sober for a few days, and I can hear what these people say in these meetings and stuff, and I can mimic, and I can copy, and I can come up with my stuff on my own, and you'll be patting me on the behind after that meeting, and I tell you I'm doing great. And I always got drunk. I have no success doing it any other way, so we just go right by the book. And we are big book thumpers where I come from. So I'm going to just kind of do it like I do when I do these treatment centers. But, you know, I've had an Alcoholics Anonymous book since 1988, and I never read the darn thing. I'd read some stuff, and some would make some sense. Some of the stuff wouldn't make any sense. And it didn't ever really sink in. I didn't really identify with much. I remember the first time I read Bill's story in 1988, and I'm thinking, man, that guy really needs to be sober, you know. I had no concept of what he was talking about because I hadn't done any of that stuff yet, you know. And I'm sure a lot more happened to Bill in Bill's life than what's in his story. But, you know, when I got sober in 99, my story made his look like a walk in the park, you know. I mean, it was a tedious process to get me to see what was in this book. And I thank God every day that I made it to a group where the people in that group, the lights are on, you know. I won't mention the group, but my last home group before this group, I mean, I got so many desire chips there. I mean, they didn't even clap anymore when I get one. And they didn't have anything to offer me either. And I was convinced that I was just going to die drunk. And that's what I tried to do in the summer of 99 because I couldn't stay sober. I'd been in 5 emergency rooms in about a 10-week period, all alcohol related. I was just resigned to the fact that I was going to drink myself to death. And that's what I tried to do that entire summer. Drink enough vodka, not the good stuff, Skol. Pop that little governor out of the top, you know, so you can drink it fast. And somehow on Labor Day weekend for that Friday, I came to and blood all over me, and I hadn't been stabbed, you know. And I had one thought that crowded out all else is, I don't want to die this way. And I detoxed myself not too far from here at my brother's house, and I made it to primary purpose on that Tuesday of September 99. And the first person I saw was this little old man who I'd met the year previous, about 80 years old, I was shaking and vibrating and stunk to holy hell. And that old man walked up to me and gave me a hug. And I looked at him and I said, I need to talk to you. And he looked back, you know, over the top of his glasses like your grandpa would do when he means business. And he says, what the hell can I do for you? And I said, I'm scared. And I don't want to drink anymore. And he said, come on. And we sat down in this little room before the meeting started. And this little old man opened up his big book. And he must have done a marvelous job 12-stepping me. Because it sunk in. So we're gonna do it the way the old man does it. And it was passed on to him like this. And this is the way we're going to roll. But if you have a big book, you open it up to the title page and it tells you right what this book is about right off the bat. It says Alcoholics Anonymous is a story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. I can't tell you how many treatment centers I've been in that tells me I'm always going to be a recovering alcoholic. And when I think of that, I'm thinking of some sniveling, whining, I'm always in recovering. That offers me no hope. That offers me no hope. They're telling me I'm going to recover from alcoholism. This is a book on how they did it. So let's see what the book says. If you turn past the table of contents to the preface in the second paragraph, it says, this book has become the basic text for our society. This is a textbook. What do you do with a textbook? We study it, right? When we got to first grade in math class, the little math teacher passed out math books to everybody. Unless you were a friggin' genius, you didn't go to the end of the book start working big problems, did you? No, we had a teacher who was there to guide each one of us students through the work so that we could learn the principles of mathematics. This is a textbook. I'm going to refer back to it over and over. It's all marked up, notes in the margin, pages falling apart. I'm going to study it. Why on earth, you ask, do I study the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? If you flip the page, it tells you right there, forward to the first edition. This is how we open up our meetings. We don't read how it works. That's granted, we're granted that right in the fourth edition. But it says, and as it was written in 1939, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered. There's that word again. Hadn't even got to the real number pages yet, and they mentioned recovered twice. And it says, we've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. A hopeless state of mind. Here's my definition. Back in the day when I was drinking, in order for me to get through the day, I had to drink no matter what, and it was killing me. In order for me to live, I had to drink, but it was killing me. That sounds like a conundrum. I don't know. I couldn't live with the booze, and I sure as heck couldn't live without the booze. But I had to drink. A hopeless state of mind and body. Now, here's another great line. It's probably one of my favorite lines. It says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we recovered is the purpose of this book. So they're telling me that the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous is giving you and me precise instructions on how to recover from the deadliest illness known to mankind, alcoholism. Alcoholism kills people that ain't even alcoholics. Precise. What does precise mean? It means exact, no gray area. The big book, the textbook, tells us how to take the steps, when to take the steps, with whom to take the steps. There's prayers and promises all along the way. Promises of what happens when you follow the directions in the big book, and there's some promises that'll come true if you don't follow directions in the big book. And I have experienced all those promises at one time or another, you know? But precise. Telling me to put the plug in the jug and keep coming back, that sounds good. They don't mean me any harm by it. But if I could not drink and go to meetings, I'd be out there not drinking and going to meetings. I have no successful experience in that. I'm a chronic, end-of-the-line, street-level alcoholic of the hopeless variety. Me sitting around a meeting hearing about your divorce one more time is not... is not a program of action for me. It says, for them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. This is the only book where we have instructions on the steps. There's lots of great books put out by Alcoholics Anonymous. I have them all. I encourage you to get them all and read them all. They're awesome. The 12 and 12 is an awesome book. There's no instructions in the 12 and 12. It's written by a guy who was 20 years sober at the time. And that's like me showing up September the 4th, 1999, and my sponsor that night, instead of 12-stepping me, he told me what his life was like today. Great! How in the heck do you get there from where I'm at? That's why we have this book. And if that rubs you the wrong way, read page 17 of the 12 and 12. It'll tell you that this book is where the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is. It says, we think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. So we're going to have chapters called Doctor's Opinion. They're going to explain this illness. We've got chapter to the wives, to the family afterward, to employers. Why? To let those folks out there know what's killing us. See, their solution for us drinking is totally different than what our solution is. You know, they get hurt, they stop. I get hurt. Oh, it wasn't that bad. I keep going, you know. And it says, and besides, we're sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. So obviously, we get sober, our lives improve. Our families' lives improve. We're better employees. We're better taxpayers, yada, yada, yada. But since these 12 steps were adopted, there's over like 280 other groups that use the same darn 12 steps. Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous. You name it, Anonymous. There's one called Messies Anonymous for people that, I guess, are too messy or not messy. I don't know. They'd have a relapse if they came to my house, that's for sure. The basic thought on that is the 12 steps work when applied to whatever is killing you out there, right? The next part of the book is forward to the second edition. Written in 1955, it tells about how AA grew, how it was started, how it grew. Grew real slow in the first. It's all word of mouth. Bill met Dr. Bob. They got Bill Dotson. Slow, slow, slow. Until some articles were written, Jack Alexander in particular, and AA blew up. Right? And it grew incrementally year after year after year after year. Until a little bit later on. And we'll get to that in just a second. The part I want to work out, talk about here is, I know, I'm doing the steps, but I got to get ramped up before, I'm getting there, okay? But if you look in the fourth to the second edition on Roman numeral 20, five lines down from the top, they give you some statistics. Now, these aren't empirical statistics. They didn't talk to every single member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the home office contacted the groups that were in existence at the time and asked them some general questions about their membership. This is what they generally found to be true. It says, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. All right? So back in the day, early AA, half got sober, stayed sober. It's pretty darn good. Real good. There's not a treatment center on this planet that can sniff 50%. It says out of 25% of those returned as time passed, right? So they had 25% of that other 50%, they had to go do some more drinking. Knuckleheads like me, you know. Weren't willing to get a sponsor, weren't willing to help anybody, weren't willing to make amends, whatever the case may be. Weren't convinced of step one, whatever. They went out and did some more drinking. 25% of them made it back. It says out of the remainder of those, 2 out of 3 returned as time passed. There's groups in existence still today with documentation from way back in the early days that were knocking out 75%, 85%. All right? AA, in the year 2000, estimated less than 5% of the folks coming into Alcoholics Anonymous are going to achieve 5 years of sobriety. I don't know about you, but that sucks. Well, how could you go from at least 50% to less than 5% in a matter of 50 years? How can that happen? I mean, alcohol is alcohol, right? Booze is 100 proof is 100 proof. Rotten, nagging spouses are still rotten, nagging spouses. Crappy jobs are crappy jobs. Problems are problems. Well, what changed? Well, I'm going to lay out how it worked back in the day and see if this matches up to your little experience today. Back in the day, we got this guy here. We'll use a guy. We've got this guy here. He's in the hospital detoxing one more time. His family has thrown more money at his disease than... I mean, he's been on the Dr. Phil show. He's been to the best treatment centers. And this guy's in the hospital detoxing, dying one more time. Back in early AA, the guys would come visit this cat in the hospital. And we sit down with this cat. And we tell him our stories. We identify him. We find out all we can about this young man. And then we leave. And then we come back the next day and we sit down with this young man again and we go through that same old spiel one more time. Find out a little bit more about him. We identify with him. We tell him our story. We tell him what it was like when we were trying to stop drinking and drinking. And then we leave. And we do this for a couple, 3 or 4 days. This guy's getting a little more clear-headed while he's in the hospital. We come back to visit him, and he knows one thing. I drank as much booze or more than he ever dreamed of drinking. And he's dying, and I ain't. And he says, "You're just like me. How do you stay sober?" Now I got him. Now I get to lay out this program, the spiritual program of action. I become that man's sponsor. We go through the steps as outlined in this book. This man recovers, and now he is helping this man. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, folks. Not once did I say it was sitting around a table talking about our days, the IRS, any of that stuff. I mean, if your doctor diagnosed you with cancer, you wouldn't go to a meeting talk about cancer for 90 days, would you? Nope. I don't think so. So let's find out what it means to be a real alcoholic, because if we don't understand step one, all the rest aren't going to make a difference. We're going to go to the doctor's opinion. This doctor's opinion was written by William D. Silkworth. Worked at Towns Hospital in New York City, a little hospital right off Central Park in New York. Worked with over 50,000 of us alcoholics and drug addicts during his tenure at Towns Hospital. All right? He was an expert on us. He loved us. But he couldn't figure out, why is it that guy or that gal that comes to his hospital that's drinking to excess? Maybe they're going through a divorce, or maybe they're going through a period of their life where they're just drinking way too much, and they end up in his hospital, and they counsel them, they nurse them back to health, they give them some hydrotherapy. I guess that means we're really clean when we leave there. I don't know what that means. They shoot water at us. I don't know. But they do all they can, and this person's scared to death that they're going to lose the rest of their family or their standing in society or whatever the case may be. And this person leaves the hospital never to return. Right? They learn their lesson. And then you got guys like me go to the same hospital, get the same treatment, knowing full well when I leave there, I cannot so much as take one drink of alcohol. Or I'm going to lose my job, my house, my car, my kids, my freedom, my dignity. Knowing all that. And I leave that hospital in high hopes. In a short amount of time, I'm right back to drinking. Man's been trying to answer that riddle since booze was invented. Hell, they've been preying on us, moving us from here to there, giving us hobbies. They've tried everything. Finally, they just come up with a solution. They just lock us up for it, you know? So this doctor came up with a theory. And when this book came out, it was just out of theory. If you can ever get a hold of a first edition, you'll notice he don't even sign his name in the first edition. All right? It's just anonymous doctor, I think, or I've seen it, but I don't remember what it said. Since then, science has proven his theory to be 100% accurate. Step one says we admitted we are powerless over alcohol. Now a completely different thought, a hyphen, that our lives have become unmanageable. All right? So let's see what the doctor says. He says, "We believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy," right? So he's saying if you're a real alcoholic, a chronic alcoholic, your body reacts differently to booze than 90% of the world population. They estimate about 1 in 10 of us have what it takes to be an alcoholic, right? An allergy. An allergy is just an abnormal reaction to something you eat or drink. Who's allergic to penicillin in here? Always. Susanna, what's up? What happens when you have... Right? And I've heard. I asked that to a lady a couple days ago, and she says, "I die." And I was like, what? She went straight past the hives and throwing up and throat constricting to die, you know? She's had a flair for the dramatic. See, isn't that odd? If I get an infection or something like that, I can go to my doctor, he gives me penicillin, and it cures me. It fixes me. Susanna can get this very same infection and go to her doctor and they give her penicillin and she swells up, you know, throat constricts, has a hard time breathing, and maybe if they gave her enough penicillin, she would die, right? She has the allergic reaction, right? That's just the way she is. That's the way I am. Doesn't matter. He's saying if you're an alcoholic, you have an allergic reaction to alcohol, right? And he says that his is how the allergic... I don't break out into like hives and I've broken into some stuff on alcohol, but I hadn't broken out anything. But this is what I got Dino in the back. I like making him laugh, you know. This is what the allergy does in a real alcoholic. He says that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in those other people. The phenomenon of craving. It's one of the things that sets me apart from those normal drinkers or those hard drinkers. See, I get the thought in my head, I'm going to take a drink, and I take the drink and I trigger this out. Is there anything that she can do other than getting an antihistamine or something, or you know whatever they do to counteract? If she takes penicillin, once she takes it, she's going to have the reaction, right? There's nothing she can do except go to the doctor and get the antidote or whatever, right? I take a drink of alcohol, I trigger this allergy, bam, my brain says, let's have another. And another, and another. It was just my intention. You know, it's Friday night, I just got paid, my boss's birthday, and everybody's going to a little pool hall to sing happy birthday to my boss, right? And I call my girlfriend, and she says, hey, I'm making your special dinner, and I have the Wonder Woman costume all lined up, right? It'll be ready at 8 o'clock, you know? And I'm like, it's my boss's birthday, I'll be home by 8, right? And it's my intentions. I love the Wonder Woman costume, you know? It's my intentions, but I get to this place, everybody's having a good time, and I take that first drink, and bam, I trigger that allergy. Now my brain says I'll have another, and another. Now I'm doing shots. Now I'm at a bar where the girls don't have any clothes on. Now I'm here. Now I'm there. Who knows when I make it home, right? The phenomenon of craving. See, it happens to alcoholics. It don't happen to those other people. I mean, did you ever get to a point where you said, no, I'm too drunk tonight? I didn't utter those words. I drank till I passed out, and I drank as soon as I came to. That's how I do this thing, right? I'm powerless. I've lost control. Once I start, I cannot control how much I drink, right? That makes sense. It's my job in the beginning when I sit down with a newcomer to lay this out. And it ain't my job to pat him on the behind and tell him I'm going to love him into sobriety. My job is to paint the picture. And I'm going to paint the picture as dark as I can. Why? Because that's my experience. I drink, I can't control how much I drink. If this was my only problem, because I know there's been many, many times where I woke up after one of those bad nights and I thought, this has got to stop. I've drank too much again. I've just got to stop because I think alcohol's the problem. Well, if this was the problem, what would be my solution? Don't drink. Makes perfect sense to a normal person. Oh, you drink too much, so don't drink. Well, that doesn't work out for me. Why? Because of the second half of step one. My life is unmanageable. Why is that? Because my mind always leads me back to the drink. Always. It always leads me back to the drink. I'll read the rest of this paragraph here. It says, these allergic types can... And the reason I read this, because I remember one, like my first or second treatment center, and I still have the big book, because I have in mind here, you know, powerless and all this stuff, you know, all my little notes and everything. But on this one particular big book that I got this treatment center, this part that I'm going to read to you, they told me that's why my life is unmanageable, right? So I'm going to read what they say. It says, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Once having formed the habit, found they can't break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them, they become astonishingly difficult to solve. And I'm just listening to what they said, and they said, that's why your life's unmanageable. It made perfect sense to me. Right? No, that's not the right answer. Those are consequences. Hell, you drink from the time you get up to the time you pass out, life becomes increasingly difficult to handle. Problems pile up. Those are consequences. Has nothing to do with why my life's unmanageable. Second half of step one, the reason my life is unmanageable, to save my life, to keep that job, to keep my freedom, to keep my girlfriend, to keep my kids, I am unable to manage the decision to stay away from the drink. Cannot do it on my own power. I've tried it over and over and over. That is why my life has become unmanageable. Has nothing to do with those consequences. Nothing. The circumstances of my life don't make me an alcoholic. Down at the bottom of that page, they say men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. It's a pretty true statement. And let's make it a real true statement. Alcoholic men and women drink essentially because we love the effect produced by alcohol. I mean, come on. Don't tell me you just drank just for the taste. I've drank some nasty stuff in my day, including rubbing alcohol. Hey, if you're stuck out in the country and you ain't got no wheels and all they got is rubbing alcohol and you need a drink, you'll drink it. Or I did, at least. I don't recommend that to anyone. I hear you can go blind or whatever. I don't know. I was in Iceland. You should see the stuff they drink. Oof. Anyway, I want the effect. I mean, I went through life before I ever took a drink. I didn't know this until, you know, now that I'm sober and all this stuff, looking back, reflecting upon my life. But I needed a drink long before I had a drink. I needed a drink. My girlfriend had it right. She drank when she was 8. You know, she held out as long as she could, man. She needed a drink when she was 8, you know. I held out till I was 15, right? But see, you know, I'm the first kid. There's 2 sets of twins behind me. I'm the first grandkid. Granddad was pretty well off in West Texas. I had the best shoes, the best clothes. My family loved me. There's no alcohol in my direct family. I had everything looking for, you know, the future looked bright. I played every sport. I was great at every sport. I made great grades. You know what I'm saying? Everybody pat me on the butt, telling me how great I'm going to be when I grow up. You know, and I dreamed that I was going to go to UT and be a lawyer like my uncle and work at his law firm. I'd be retired by now, you know. Except I had this little voice in my head. You're telling me I'm great, but I had the little voice in my head going, "You're a friggin' loser." You know what I'm saying? I was like, we moved around a lot. I was self-conscious. I was real shy. I'd meet some friends and then we'd move, right? But I had that little voice in my head. You know, I walk into this room and I think you're all staring at me. What did I do? I just didn't fit. The twins below me, they bond. And, you know, I don't fit. Until I was 15 at tennis camp in Florida and I took my first drink. And then I fit. All the dots were connected. The keys to the universe were in my possession. Those chicks that I was with, they wanted me. You know what I'm saying? I was hip, slick, and cool, you know? I want that effect. I want that effect. Right? It says this sensation is so elusive. See, I had that effect for years and years and years until the tables turned, and I couldn't quite keep that effect. Oh, I just drink right on past it. It was fleeting, you know what I'm saying? I don't know if it was the third drink or the fifth martini or whatever, but I'd get that effect, but I've already triggered and I'm gone. I overshoot the effect over and over. The sensation is elusive. You know, it's like trying to catch a greased up balloon or a pig or something. It's just elusive. I can't just get to that sense of ease and comfort and stop. Why? Because I got this allergy telling me to drink another and another and another. It says that while they admit it is injurious, oh, I got some injuries. Now, the injuries don't make me an alcoholic, but I got plenty of injuries. Oh, I've been to jails. Only 2 times. I've been to jail twice. I mean, it's not like I'm a hardened veteran, you know, of jail. I can't stand up here and say, oh, I could do jail time standing on my head, you know. That's nothing. I've wrecked cars. Most of the wrecks that I've had in cars were not my cars. They were your cars, you know. I was always driving them. Been to 5 treatment centers. I don't know how many hospitals. I don't know how many friends I've lost, how many great jobs I've lost, family members I've lost. How about dignity? Ooh, I lost some dignity too. Alcohol took me to places I never dreamed I'd go. Took me with people I never dreamed. Hell, I'd go home with Bo Derek, wake up with Bo Diddley. You know? I've used that joke for like 6 years now, and it always gets a laugh. But yeah, I had some injuries. I mean, that's the truth. I leave this building today, and I go have a drink. That stuff starts to happen, and in a hurry. I mean, a little bit before I got sober, I left one day before I'd ever had a drink, had a little like 2 months of sobriety, and I left this little halfway house. All I was going to do was look for an apartment. And I ended up in jail with a felony possession, PI, and kicking a cop in the chest who was trying to pull me out of a cab. I mean, that's where my drinking took me to. right? That's the truth about my drinking. But what does my brain tell me? It's not that bad. Just a little bad luck. I had bad luck for the 90s, you know? It was all bad. Everything was bad. I had a psychiatrist when I was like 19 years old was telling me, you know, list all the bad things in your life. And even at 19, all the bad things that I considered bad in my life were all a direct result of alcohol. I drank 17 more years, you know. It was a tedious process. It says to them, well, I'm going to hold my finger on that page. And I'm going to go to, see, I'm going to give you the bad news of step one. You go over here to, there's a solution, page 24. It's in italics. This is the bad news of step one. It says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. They're saying if you're a real alcoholic, you ain't got no choice in the matter. You're gonna. It's not a matter of if you're going to drink. It's when you're going to drink. It says, our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. Now, here's the tricky part. This is the part I like to ram home all the time in little treatment centers because this is the part that I never understood. It says, we're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Welcome to your life being unmanageable. They're saying that the day that I take my last drink, within a certain amount of time, and it varies. For me, my life unravels quickly when I'm not drinking. So the time frame is very, very short. But they're saying the day I take that last drink, I get removed from that last drink. My little brain is unable to come up with a solution to not drink. I can't remember it. Well, let's do a little test. Close your eyes and think of the worst, most painful, degrading experience you had as a direct result of drinking. So what were you doing 24, 48 hours later? Oh, drinking. Isn't that amazing? Amazing. First time I got thrown in jail. God, I prayed all day long. And I'd been kind of 12-stepped a little bit, and I kind of knew a little bit more than I had done in previous times. And I'm praying all day long and loose there. God, if you'll get me out of this, I'll do anything. I'll call Frank back. I'll get the best lawyer I can get, and I'll get out of this, and I'll go back to my meetings. And, you know, and I'm just praying all day long. And I'm in bad shape, bad, bad shape, shaking it out. And I mean, it's horrible. My little boss at the time bonded me out that day. I got thrown in jail on Sunday night sometime. I bonded out Monday evening. And I'm walking out loose there, and I'm putting my watch on my wrist, and my watch says 8:47. And I ran across the street and bought me another bottle of vodka. You think that I walked into the liquor store and put that vodka up there and said, hey, I just got the hell kicked out of me and I got a felony possession, a PI kicking a cop in the chest. Give me another bottle of this stuff, man. No, but I had to drink. I drank no matter what. See, left to my own devices, I'm unable to manage the decision to stay away from booze. I've lost the power to choose. Those are the only two questions you need to answer in your little heart of hearts for step one. I know they've got little pamphlets that say 20 questions or 40 questions. Hey, if you answer those two questions, you're going to answer all the rest of those other questions. I think. I don't know. I've answered them all. Hell, drink in the morning, drink at night. Yeah, I mean, you name it. Lost jobs, lost. I mean, come up with 100 questions. They're all going to be checked. True, true, true. It doesn't matter. I've lost the power to control it. I've lost the power to choose. Welcome to step one. But let's look what Bill says more about step one. Go over to page 30, and I love the way he writes. This is why we do a big book study all the time in my group. Why? So we can learn what's in here. Look what he says. He says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. See, when I was in college, I'd be proud to tell you I was an alcoholic. Why? Because it was fun. I drank better than most people. I didn't get sloppy back then. I didn't slur my words. I could drive better, dance better. You name it, man. It was good. I was proud of it. But towards the end, now I'm hiding booze, and I lived alone. Go figure. I don't know. Don't know what I was thinking. We cleaned up my apartment when I sobered up. There was, you know, y'all been through it. There was booze everywhere. I didn't want to admit that I was a real alcoholic. See, I went through like most of the 90s trying to still prove that you were the reason why I was an alcoholic. That's why I moved to Puerto Rico. Drunker and you know what. I just had to get away from Dallas. Tried to blame it on my family for a while. Trying to wish upon, I mean, I'm not making light of this, but wishing that I was like, you know, abused as a kid. That must be why. I must have been abused as a kid. That's why I'm an alcoholic, you know. I didn't want to admit I was a real alcoholic. It says no person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Bodily different from the allergy. Mentally different because I have a mind that leads me to the drink. See, my mental obsession is subtle. They call it cunning, baffling, powerful. See, I go to the little meeting, get a desire chip, and make a go at AA, and they tell me to keep coming back. They tell me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I do that. And because I'm an alcoholic, I think, well, I'll do that, and I'll even join the sober softball team, you know, and I'll get some Tony Robbins books, and I'll start running 5 miles a day, doing push-ups, doing good deeds for my mama, you know. You see me at a meeting, I tell you, you ask me how I'm doing, I tell you I'm doing great, feel better, sleep better, everything is great, God is wonderful, right? But inside, it ain't that great. Because I'm like an actor. See, little by slowly, I'm unraveling on the inside. And maybe somebody in my group tells me, man, maybe you just need to double up on your meetings. Okay. Maybe you just need to make out a gratitude list. Oh, okay. And the days go by, and I unravel a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And I don't like feeling that way. Start feeling a little self-pity. Start feeling some fear. Start feeling that feeling of uselessness. Why me? You know? If you ask me how I'm doing, I tell you I'm doing good. See, I feel that way long enough, that spiritual malady. I feel that way long enough. I don't like feeling that way. My little mind says, I don't know why the world treats you so poorly. You're a good guy. You look a little stressed, John Kelly. Stress is very, very dangerous. I'm here to help you. I love you. It'll be different this time. What you and I need to do is we need to go on down to Centennial and just get us a little pint of vodka. I know you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. This is just between me and you. No one will know. That's the mental obsession. And that is the death sentence for an alcoholic. Because the mental obsession condemns an alcoholic left to his own devices to drink to the bitter end. It tells me when I work with others to stress the hopelessness of the situation, so I hope I'm doing a good job. It says, therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. I bet there's some provers in this room. Trying to prove, hoping against all hope, that the previous 1,000 experiences of my drinking, tonight I'm going to be a miracle of control. Tonight I'm just going to have a couple, enjoy the evening, and call it a night. I'm going to prove. Maybe I'm not going to drink tequila. I'm a vodka and Rumpelmans type of person. You know, the higher the proof, the better for me. You know, so I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to drink beer. I swell up, you know. To prove that. Now, here we go. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. See, my brain tells me that I can control and enjoy it. Now, I don't know about you. If I ever tried to control it, I sure as heck wasn't enjoying it. Anybody ever try to control your drinks for you? I went to a party with a girl one time, and it was like a cash bar at this party. And so I gave her my money, right? And so she was buying the drinks. And she was, because we'd had some run-ins, you know. So she's buying the drinks, right? After the first couple of drinks, I'm trying to figure out a way that I can kill her so I can get my money back, you know. Because I was not having a good time. And we ended up having to leave that place. I can't control and enjoy it. And if I'm enjoying, I sure as heck ain't controlling it. Right? But my mind, I mean, think about it. Think not this time. I know you're all big book thumpers in here and everybody's rocking and rolling. But think back to one of those other times when you swore you're never going to do it again. Right? You were given sufficient reason. Right? Maybe it was a job. Maybe it was the relationship. Maybe it was just you looking in the mirror and you swore you were never, ever going to do it again. Right? And maybe you went to church more. Maybe you did more good deeds. Maybe you went to AA. Right? But you didn't drink. My question is how free were you? Because if you were like me, I wasn't even drinking. But you know what? I was thinking about not drinking. I ain't even drinking back then, and booze still owns me. Hell, they're telling me to stay away from my playmates, playthings. Oh. The mental obsession is a killer. So they call it an obsession. And look at this next one. The persistence of this illusion. What's the illusion? That I can control and enjoy it. That I can drink like a gentleman. That I can drink like a normal person. That is an illusion. Well, what's an illusion? If I turn this book into a parakeet, did I really do it or did I trick you? That's what an illusionist does. He makes us see things that aren't there. My illusion back in the day was that somehow I'll be able to drink normally. I have no experience, although I have no experience drinking normally. Never done that. Got drunk the first time out and damn near every time thereafter. But my illusion is that I can drink normally. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. I don't know about y'all when I started drinking, but going insane from it or dying from it, we're not on the horizon. That's where alcoholism took me too. You know? That's just the ugly truth. And it says we had to learn, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step. I got to concede in my heart of hearts. Right? No lurking notion. In my group, we call it the Holy Trinity. I know there's a real Holy Trinity, so I don't mean to be blasphemous, but we'll just call it the Trinity. The Alcoholics Trinity. Right? The job, the car, and the girl. If I can just get the job, the car, and the girl, my life will be okay. See, I was under that illusion a long time too. That if I can get these external circumstances in my life situated, I wouldn't drink. That's not a step one. If you can get sober that way, more power to you. My hat's off to you. I cannot do that. I have no experience doing that. I just had a talk with a treatment center in Dallas the other day. And that's what they're telling these guys. You don't need to work the steps right now. You need to get your job situation squared away and get this stuff. You know? That's pretty scary, folks. You know, I'm thankful that we get to go carry the message there, but good God, that's a real uphill battle. Because I'm telling them the exact opposite. The big book is telling them the exact opposite. You know? I got to know in my heart of hearts that I am, A, in fact, an alcoholic. You know? I got to know here. I knew up here for a long time. But see, I could never admit that I was a real alcoholic because I didn't know what a real alcoholic was. You know, finally, thank God I started going to jail, started having some more car wrecks, and started ending up in hospitals. I've gone through DT twice. You know, I've had some seizures, you know. So in some people's eyes, you're an alcoholic, right? I still was drinking. I mean, Bill puts it real good in his story. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I was overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And that was like all. That's how I felt. 1998, 1999. I had no other option except to drink. You know, drink for the end. Drink for the end. Because I was convinced, because of what I was told. what I thought I knew about this program, I was convinced that I didn't have a shot. I was convinced. I remember the day. I don't know what day it was because these days were kind of blackout among blackout. But I remember this one little conversation I had with my boss, and I had quit this job. It's kind of towards the tail end of summer of 99. Because I'd called. This guy was kind of irrational. He got kind of pissed off at me because I called in sick on Monday and Tuesday, and I was calling in sick on Wednesday. And it's like the 50th time I've done that. So he got a little upset with me. It's kind of unreasonable. But anyway, so I fired myself and started drinking real heavily, you know, just to try to die. And I just remember thinking to myself, you know, God, I'm not mad at you. I'm not pissed off. I'm just going to be one of these guys that's going to have to die drunk, and I'm okay with that, but please make it hurry. I felt just like Bill did on page 8 that I just read. Just in that morass of self-pity, that morass of self-involvement, that morass, you know? And that's how I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. Stinking, vibrating, shaking. Not a hope in the world. I don't know. There must have been a little angel with me that day. Because that Tuesday that I got my last desire check was a long day. Long day. I'm 3 days after my last drink. I can barely walk. My brother drops me off at my place in Oak Cliff. He went through and we've got all the bottles that we could find and threw them away. And I'm supposed to go to our meeting that night. And I had another sponsor at the time. And he called me. He'd called me a couple times during the day. You going to make it tonight? I'm going to make it. Now, I'm not telling him that my brain is saying drink. I've got $22 to my name, I believe. 22, 23, something like that. All I had. And my brain is telling me to drink. And he calls me at 5 o'clock or 5:30 that day and says, look, my wife is giving birth. I'm not going to be there tonight, so you talk to Cliff. And I said, okay. Somehow I made it there. And I already told you, he gave me a hug, and we went to a little side room before the meeting started. And he sat me down before that meeting started, and he blew my mind on alcoholism. He disturbed me greatly about alcoholism. He gave me a good case of alcoholism. Why? Because he's recovered and been given the power to help me. He drank as much booze as I ever did. And I was the one dying, and he's not. He was free. You could see it in his little eyes, the little sparkle in his eye, the twinkle in his eye. This guy had the power. And he painted me into a corner. And then he asked me the question, are you a real alcoholic? And I'm crying and snotting all over myself. And I'm, yes, sir, I am. And he said, John Kelly, you're screwed. He used another word for screwed. I'll let you use your own imagination. And I'd thought that for years about my own situation. But for the first time in my life, that sunk home. I'm going to die drunk. He tells me that, and then he looks at me and he says, do you think it works for me? And I said, I know it works for you. He says, well, how well is your way working? And I said, it's not. He says, what the hell do you have to lose except your life? And that's when he informed me that he was now my sponsor. And I was going to call him when he told me to call him. I was going to read what he told me to read. I was going to show up where he told me to show up. And we were going to take these steps the way it's outlined in this book, or else. And the or else for my sponsor is go away. Don't waste my time. That was my last entrance to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll finish up there next week, and I'll end here tonight. But all I did in that little meeting, that little brief meeting with that old man, is I took steps 1 and 2. I came to 2 conclusions. I'm screwed, and I hope. Welcome to steps 1 and 2. And I'll go into step 2 in more detail. That's it. I meet people all the time that are telling me, Well, I'm still working on step two. I've been working on step two for like a year. Well, what's there to work on? You hope it works or it don't, you know? Anyway, so it's very, very good to be here. I had a great time when I was here in the summer and I spoke. I don't know, I remember a lot of your faces. And I just want to thank you because, I mean, I love seeing all of your smiles. I mean, if any of you go to other groups, I mean, sometimes it's like speaking to a hostile environment, you know. And I love you people, and I've told everybody I can tell about, you know, if they're ever in Fort Worth, to come by here. Because I was treated so nicely the last time I was here and so far tonight. So don't screw it up, okay? Thank you for having me. Debbie. No, she's not around. Long gone. If anybody knows her, I need to make an amends. Wow. Thank you, Walter, for that introduction. I'll probably lay a dud here tonight, you know. My name's John Kelly. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September the 4th, 1999, and for that I am very, very grateful. You know, I'm not just one of these dudes that walk around going, oh, I got me a little job today. God is so good. You know, I got me a car today. Look what God's doing for me. I got me a girlfriend today. Look what God's doing for me. God don't want to hear that from me. He wants to see me in action. So what better way for me to thank the God of my understanding than I get off my rear end and take this message to somebody who was dying just like I was. That's how I show God I'm grateful. Because for without this, I would not be here tonight, that's for sure. So we're doing the steps. I spent all last week, in case you missed it last week, I spent all last week dwelling on the hopelessness of the situation. The hopelessness of the situation. That's what the big book tells me. If I'm a sponsor, it tells me, you know, pages 92 through 96, it tells me exactly, it lays it out, how I'm supposed to take people through the steps, what I'm supposed to talk about, when I'm supposed to talk about it. And you notice when I dwelt on the hopelessness of the situation, I didn't offer you an inkling of what the solution was. Right? And that's what I'm supposed to do as a sponsor. Right? And, if you look at the history of it, you know, Bill got sober and he was for 5.5 months, he was going around the Boweries of New York City, going up to every drunk he knew, tell him about his hot flash experience in Towns Hospital, right? Can you imagine him sitting down? He's sober. He's got the little twinkle in his eye. And he's sitting down with a drunk, right? And he's telling him, wow. And he tells about this hot flash, right? And not a one of them stayed sober. And legend has it that he was at home kind of frustrated and talking to Lois. And she's like, you dope. You're sober, you know? So then he goes back to Silkworth and talks to Silkworth, and Silkworth says, hey, man, you're putting the cart before the horse. Lay out the hopelessness of the situation. Lay out this allergy to alcohol. Give them the scientific facts about alcoholism. Then, if they identify with you and they ask you how you stay sober, then you can lay out the solution, but not before. Right? So that's... My girlfriend says I do a pretty good job dwelling on the hopelessness of the situation. So what did I learn last week? I learned in step one that I'm screwed. That's the short form of step one. I'm screwed, you know. But who better to explain that to me was someone who was at one time dying just like I was. And he has recovered and been given the power to help me. He is properly armed with the facts about himself. Right? He's been where I was at, and he knows the way out. And so he painted that picture for me that first night, September the 4th, 1999. Now, that wasn't my first night in AA. That was like my 37th or 38th desire chip that night. I was trying to get sober since 1988. Been to hundreds and hundreds of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Listened to all the stories. You know? But that man, that night... disturbed me greatly on the problem of alcoholism. And he did it in masterful. I mean, it was like in just a couple of minutes, as near as I can remember. I was in pretty bad shape that night. He kind of painted me into a corner. And he shared with me some of his experiences. He asked me some questions about mine. He talked about the allergy, that loss of control, that once I start drinking, I am powerless to control how much I drink. It doesn't matter what my intentions are. My intentions were that I was going to drink like a normal person. Now, that's a crazy thought in itself, since I never have any experience of drinking like a normal person. But, you know, I spent years and years trying to drink, thinking I was going to drink like a normal person. Once I start, I cannot control how much I drink. And that's some bad news, right? But that's not the bad news of step one. The bad news of step one is that my life has become unmanageable. The bad news of step one is that left to my own devices, on my own power, I am unable to manage the decision to stay away from the very first drink. Can't do it. Tried every trick. Tried every self-help. You should see my library at home, and I got everything. And I can hook you up if you want to try some of that. Tony Robbins, Tai Chi. You know, I can show it. Just in case you haven't tried Tai Chi, it's hard to do when you're hungover to get in those 44 positions. You know, it's hard. And so he painted me into a corner, and he asked me the question: am I a real alcoholic? And if you look on page 44, if you have a big book. Ask you, there's a little test. It says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Well, I quit hundreds of times. I desperately didn't want to end up the places that I was ending up. I quit, but I couldn't stay quit. So I failed that one. Or it says, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take. Well, once I start, it's damn near impossible for me to stop. And at the end of my drinking career, the only time I did stop is when I winded up in jail or in the hospital. Well, that's how I stopped. You know, it says you're probably an alcoholic. If that's the case, you're suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Now, there may be some people in this room going, you know, I've been around in AA and I think it sucks and I don't believe in this spiritual experience crap. Really? Well, remember back when you were drinking, when you were having one of those bad days? I mean, the bad days were like, the job's not working out, the relationship's not working out, the family stuff's not working out, the kids are screaming, your puppy's sick, the car don't start, you got to catch the DART bus sucks, nobody loves you. Remember having one of those days? How'd you feel when you took a couple of drinks? Changed the way I thought and felt, didn't it? Didn't fix any of my problems, but I had a psychic change. Right? So now we know one exists. We know it exists. All right? And it says later on, it says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or live life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. So there I was. I was going to drink myself to death or have this experience. And those were my two choices. That's where I was at. You know? And I love page 45 in the big book. Now, you'll have to pardon me. I could sit up here and I'm not like some of these speakers that go around and pontificate on my great wisdom, on my great insight on the steps. All right? My sponsor's pretty cut and dry. He says, read the damn book. You can't screw it up. So if you have a problem with what I say, contact the author. You know? Because I'm coming straight out of this book, right? But I love what it says at the end of the first paragraph on 45. It says, our human resources as marshaled by the will were not sufficient. They failed utterly. That means each and every time me trying to fix a situation fails utterly. Always happens. I always drink. So now they give us a real lightning bolt here. It says lack of power. That's our dilemma. Step one says we're powerless. That's my dilemma. Lack of power. I ain't got no power on this. And it says we had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. So let's break that down. Maybe sitting there thinking, I don't believe in this higher power. I don't believe in this stuff. Well, let me put it to you this way. How about booze? Was that a power greater than you? Did booze get you to do some things you never dreamed you'd do? End up with people you never dreamed you'd end up with? Did anybody ever wake up in a different town or a different state thinking, where in the heck am I? You know? I read that book, Million Little Pieces. You know, the opening page, anybody's read it, you know, the guy wakes up on an airplane, comes to, and he's bleeding and stuff. And I'm thinking, who hadn't done that? You know? So now we know there is a power greater than me. Booze was a power greater than me. Some people say, hey, hit a cop. You'll find out a power greater than you, you know. But now it says we have to find a power by which we could live. So we already know booze is a power greater than me, but it says I had to find a power by which I could live. Could I live by booze anymore? No, booze was killing me. So I know a power exists, and it ain't booze. Right? So I got to find another power. And it says, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. So I got to find another power, and it ain't me. I'm not the power. I can't fix the situation. It says, obviously, but where and how are we going to find this power? That's what this book is about. Its main object is to enable us to find a power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem. Why do you think they wrote the book? Why do you think there's 12 steps lead us somewhere? Steps lead us from one point to another point, right? I'm powerless over here in step one. I'm going to take these steps that are guaranteed to get me to the power. I said a guarantee last week, and I'm going to show it to you this week. There's a couple of them in here. But that's why they wrote the book. The steps, the precise instructions in this book tell us how to get to the power that's going to save our life. Now we got to get to the power, right? And they talk about, that's why they, it goes on the rest of this page, they talk about why they wrote this book, right? It's to give us instructions. And I love this part. You know, I mean, don't be a dope like me. The first time I got my first big book and I started thumbing through the chapters and stuff, because I like to read a lot, I got to We Agnostics and I thought, well, I'm not agnostic. And I just blew right through it, you know? I didn't read it, you know? Don't do that. But what they're going to talk about in this chapter is, you know, there's lots of stuff that block us from this power. There's lots of stuff that blocked me from getting sober all those years. I had prejudices, you know? I had fixed ideas of what I thought AA was, what I thought higher power was, what I thought God was, what I thought this book was about, what I thought the program was about. I had all sorts of ideas and prejudices. And Bill goes to great length in this chapter to talk about why is it that we've done so much in this last century when it took all those many, many centuries to get us to that point. Are we that much smarter? No. I mean, think about Columbus, you know? But he sailed east to go west, or sailed west to go east, right? You know there were some suckers back in Italy when or Portugal or wherever he took off from. You know they were sitting there on the beach going, as soon as that SOB gets across the horizon, he's off the edge of the earth, you know? They had prejudices. Right? I had lots of prejudices blocking me. But I was convinced on that first night back in AA in 99, I knew the seriousness of the situation. My sponsor told me I was screwed. Right? And then he asked me another question. He says, do you believe that it works for me? And I can remember looking him right in the eye, and his little eyes sparkled and stuff, and I knew it worked for him. I'd heard his story several times before. This was a bottom-of-the-barrel drunk. And something worked in his life. And he says, does it work for the rest of those people out there in that meeting? And I'm like, well, yeah, I know it works. He says, well, then what the hell do you have to lose except your life? And that's when he informed me that he was going to become my sponsor. And I was supposed to call him at 8 o'clock every morning. He was going to tell me where to be, what to read, and where to show up to. And it was my job to follow his lead. If I want what he's got, I got to do what he does, right? He gave me some instructions that first night. And he told me, when I got home that night, we didn't talk about God that first night. We didn't talk about higher power or anything like that. But he told me when I got home to look up at my ceiling and say thanks. And you know, tell my ceiling if I had to, thanks that I have another shot. Thanks that I met a big book thumper who was awake. Thank you, God, for giving me another shot. And he said, you'll sleep like a baby. And I doubted that very seriously. I got home that night and I had to call my sainted mother. You know, and I called her on my little cell phone. And I don't know if I told you all this story last night, but I'll tell it again. And, you know, my mom, like we do, you know, I put my family through all sorts of stuff. They hit their all-time lows as a direct result of me and my actions and my alcoholism, and they don't even drink. And she's heard every con, every lie in the book. And she knew I was going to that meeting that night, and she knew I was supposed to meet my older sponsor. And I called her, and she says, "Did you go to the meeting?" I said, "Yes, ma'am, I did." And she goes, "Was Matthew there?" And I said, "No, he wasn't." And you could just hear her little voice sink on the phone. And I said, "Well, his wife is having a baby tonight, so he couldn't be there, but I got another sponsor." And she said, "Who is that?" And I said, "Cliff Bishop." And she started crying. And I said, "Well, why are you crying?" And she says, "Because I've been praying." And I said, "Well, I'm scared of the old man." And he told me to read some stuff and I need to say a prayer and I just got to follow his directions. All right? Now look what it says here, and I follow those directions, right? And right in the middle of page 46, because this is a huge promise, right in the middle of the page it says, "We found that as soon as we're able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe and a power greater than ourselves," here's the promise, "we commence to get results, even though it's impossible for us to fully define or comprehend that power which is God." It's a whole mouthful. I didn't read that night. I came across this a few days later, a few weeks later. But that night, after I said that prayer and talked to my mom and all that stuff, and I laid down on my little sofa that was the only piece of furniture I had in that house, I knew one thing, and I remember this as clear as day. That first night back in AA, desire chip number 38, or whatever it was, I knew one thing. It crowded out all other thoughts. I don't ever have to have another drink. Ever. Didn't know how that was going to work. But I had that feeling, you know. Seems like I laid aside prejudice and expressed even a willingness to believe that what worked for him could work for me. I had no more bargaining chips. I had nothing else to no more plan Bs. You know, I was convinced for all those years that if I just got the right job, the right car, the right girl, that everything would be okay. If I just got the heat off my back, it would be okay. And I'm one of these that, you know, if you read at the bottom of 47, I like this. It says, "Besides the seeming inability to accept much on faith, we found ourselves handicapped by obstinacy, sensitiveness, and unreasoning prejudice. Many of us have been so touchy that even casual reference to spiritual things made us bristle with antagonism." Ooh. Man, I used to go to those meetings and I hear people talking about spiritual this, spiritual that, and it was like somebody with their hands on the chalkboard. You know why? Because I figured, you know, I've done so much crap in my life and I've told so many lies and I've hurt so many people that there is no way for me to get out from under. That's prejudice. It says this sort of thinking had to be abandoned. Though some of us resisted, we found no great difficulty in casting aside such feelings. You want to know why? Read on. It says, "Faced with alcoholic destruction, we soon became as open-minded on spiritual matters as we tried to be on other questions. In this respect, alcohol was a great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness." I'm one of those knuckleheads. I had to go to the bitter end. You know, I had to have alcohol beat my brains in before I was willing to accept your help. Because I always had a plan. Always. You know, and for years and years, my plans worked to some extent. But as alcoholism took its toll, my plans quit working and I kept trying. You know, it's all I got to know for step two. I just got to hope. You know, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. If you go back to page 25, it says, "There is a solution." And I'll skip on a couple lines, and it says, "But we saw that it really worked in others." There is a solution. It works for you. Whatever I'm trying ain't working. And it says, "And we'd come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we'd been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those with whom the problem had been solved, there's nothing left for us but to pick up this simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet." That's some pretty cool stuff. Pretty easy. Now we're going to flip on. I mean, there's some great stuff in here. A guy pointed out to me a long time ago. He goes, "You probably know what the solution is already, but you just are too boneheaded to believe it." And he walked away. And I didn't really get that at that time. And he didn't explain the deep spiritual significance of what he just said. And I kind of left it at that. But if you read on into We Agnostics on page 55, the second paragraph, it says, actually, we're fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And if you don't like me talking about God, I'll talk about higher power. But they're saying that every one of us has this fundamental idea. So let's take a test. I love tests. Y'all know that from last week. I love tests. So everybody think of a situation in your life where you screwed up. I mean screwed up. You got caught stealing from work. You got caught with the flash. The cops are behind you and you got a trunk load of outside issues, or you were cheating on your little relationship, or whatever it is, right? You look over at your court-appointed attorney looking at that dipshit and thinking, he ain't going to get me out, you know? We've been in those situations to some extent, right? Did anybody in this room ever kind of just do a little time out in your mind and say, if you will get me out of this, I swear I will never do this again, right? Anybody ever do that? Who were you talking to? Ah, I got you. Oh, I'll get you on this one too. More importantly, who taught you how to do that? Nobody. My mama didn't pull me aside when I was 5 years old and says, hey, when S hits the fan, look up and say, if you get me out. Nobody told me that. I instinctively knew. Why did I know that? Because I was desperate. They weren't going to get me out of it. They weren't going to get me out of it. I sure as heck wasn't going to get me out of it. My back was against the wall. I had nothing else to turn to. So I pleaded to the emptiness of the air, please get me out of this and I'll never do it again. Most of the time, that worked. I got out of it to some extent in some cases. Did I hold up my end of the bargain? No. Why? Because the heat was off. As soon as the heat's off, I go back doing what I always do. Right? Alcohol beat me into a state of... And it says, we found the great reality deep down within us. I searched out there all over the country and all over the Caribbean. I looked for something out there to fix what was wrong in here. More jobs, more cars, more girls, more money, more this, more that. You should see how many Nikes I have. I got every friggin' pair. Why? Because they make me feel good, you know? I searched out there, and he's saying, I'm going to find the power in here. Huh. It says, we can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice. And they mention the word prejudice over and over and over in this chapter. Enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself. Then, if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. Now, here's the guarantee. It says, with this attitude, you cannot fail. Sounds like a guarantee. Hey, look, there ain't no treatment center on this planet offering a guarantee. Hey, come to Betty Ford, we'll cure you. They ain't offering that. They're telling me if I go here with no prejudice, go here with an open mind, I cannot fail. Sounds like a guarantee to me. And I'd go as far to say, you can bet your life on that. I did. It seems to work. I love reading how it works. So I've come to two conclusions at this point. I'm screwed and I hope. It says now we're at the turning point, right? And it says, tells us in how it works, Walter just read, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, right? You look at the statistics from old-timey AA, they were doing at least 50% for years and years and years. There's groups today still doing 90%. Dr. Bob's group today still meets one night a week. They still do 90% or better. Why? Because they are good sponsors. They qualify them. If you ain't willing to do the work, go away. Don't waste our time. Right? They're 90% successful. All the guys that I've sponsored, all the guys who are thoroughly following the path, guess what? They're sober today. The guys who didn't thoroughly follow the path, all bets are off. So it's still a pretty true statement. Then it tells us who's not going to get it. Those who do not recover, people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Cannots and will not. I know a heck of a lot of will nots. Know a ton of those. I was a will not for years. Would not see your way of life. Would not get a sponsor. Would not read the book. Would not follow directions. Would not. Cannots are those people, I don't know, go to tarot, go to Souls Harbor. You know, men and women look just like us. Went to the bottle that one last time, and they ain't ever coming back. Never, ever. You know? And it says, constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. In the preface, it says that inside this book, this is a textbook. In the fourth to the first edition, it says there's precise instructions on how to recover. If I'm convinced of step one, 100%, and I hope it works in step two, and I've got a prescription for a miracle right here, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, today, if I'm being honest with myself, I will do absolutely anything to follow these principles to the best of my ability. That's being honest with myself. I wake up tomorrow and I choose not to pray and I choose not to call my sponsor and I choose not to help another drunk and I choose to run the show myself. Guess what? I ain't being very honest with myself. And the clock starts ticking. And with a hopeless chronic relapser like me, the clock don't have to tick very long before I pick up a drink. And it says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. That's how you tell your story. Right? Bill's story is a great example of how you tell your story. And here's a little condition here for taking a step. It says, if you decided you want what we have, right? I want what you got. I was never willing to, because here's the next part. And you're willing to go to any length to get it. There's what always got me for those years. Oh, I wondered what you got. I ain't willing to do anything about it. I just try to get it by osmosis. I'll just come to a bunch of meetings. I'll just go to meeting after meeting. I'll be a meeting maker. They say meeting makers make it. All right? So there's a condition. If you want what we got and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take the steps. All right? I'm not going to read that whole part, but I like that part. It says, half measures avail us. Well, it says we stand at the turning point, right? We stood at the turning point. And here's the mother of all prayers. We ask His protection and care with complete abandon. The mother of all prayers. I don't know how it's going to work. I just hope it works. Please help me. I'm at the turning point. What am I going to do? Am I going to do what I always did? Be a little meeting maker? Hang on for dear life? I'm just glad to be sober today. You know? Be miserable? Or am I going to follow these directions? Right? ABCs gives you a short recap of steps one and two, that we're alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Check. B, that no human power could relieve my alcoholism. My mom couldn't fix it. The judge couldn't. You know, I mean, I know you guys aren't in, I mean, I speak at a lot of treatment centers and stuff, so I always ask them, say, how many of y'all have given you a dirty UA? And all these hands go up, and I say, well, hell, the judge couldn't keep you sober either. No human power could keep me away from the bottle. And it says that God could and would if He were sought. If you're sought in something, that means you're taking some actions, right? You're looking, right? And it says, being convinced of those, we're now at step three. Two conclusions, and now I'm at step three. It's not rocket science we're performing here, folks. Says, which is that we decide to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood them. Got the little steps on the wall there. I used to think it was like a first cafeteria. Step one, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Step two, sure, I believe in God. Step three, God, you can have my will and my life, right? If I knew how to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God, I would have done that years and years ago. I have no idea how to do that. That's why they're going to explain to us how to do that. That's what the steps are for. The steps are in place to get us to turn our will and our life over to this God. All right? And he talks about being, he says the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. My life was no success running it on my own. I'd lost every job I had, lost every friend I ever had, pissed off every family member I had, did things I knew I shouldn't, ended up places I knew I'd never be. In my right mind, my life was not successful. So Bill goes on to use an analogy. He says that an alcoholic is like an actor who wants to direct a movie. Right? He says, I'm like a little actor who's got one line in a movie, and I show up the first day of shooting, right? And I start telling Martin Scorsese how to do the lights, the scenery, the ballet, the caterers, right? Because see, I'm convinced if my mama would do this and get off my back, and this girlfriend would do this and get off my back, and the boss would ease up on me and I can get the heat off me, I'm convinced if I can get all these things put in place in my life, I would be very, very happy, and so would you. Well, that's pretty arrogant, don't you think? You don't need me bossing you around. Finally, see, in order for me to get my way, to get you to do well, I can be very, very nice to you. I can pay you a compliment, flash you a little smile. I can do that. And if that don't work, F you. I'm going to get what I need to get. Why? Because I'm convinced if I get these things, that I'm going to be okay. Well, in trying to make these arrangements, I piss you off. You don't need me bossing you around all the time. Now you're going to retaliate against me. Now I hate you. See how simple that is? That's me running the show. I am very, very self-centered left to my own. I'm self-centered now. You know? But that's me running the show. And that's what he's saying to us little alcoholics are. We're self-will run riot. Arrangements. At the bottom of page 61, he calls us egocentric. Right? Kind of flowery word. If you flip the page to 62, he just cuts right to the chase. He says selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of our troubles. Wait a second, I thought alcohol was the root of my troubles. No. Alcohol is a symptom. My problems go a little bit deeper than a bottle of booze. Well, let's see if that's true. I'm going to hold my finger on that page. I'm going to flip back to page 52, right in the middle of the page. Stone cold sober, back in the day, left to my own devices, here's what I feel like. I'm having trouble with my personal relationships. Any of y'all have some of those? It says, I can't control my emotional natures. Now, that doesn't mean I cry when I see a little Easter bunny and stuff. How do I react when it don't go my way? I get pissed. I'm happy one minute, I'm yelling at you the next, right? Can't control my emotional natures. It says, I'm a prey to misery and depression. Poor me. Why does my mama love my sister more than she loves me? I don't have a good job. I got a record now. I don't have a car. I got to catch the DART bus. The DART bus sucks. Prey to misery and depression. Couldn't make a living. Had a feeling of uselessness, full of fear, unhappy, stone cold, sober. Spiritual malady. That's me left to my own devices. Untreated alcoholism right there. Selfishness, self-centeredness. There ain't nothing I just read on page 52 that's not selfish. Any of you guys go to treatment centers and carry the message? You see those little things on the wall that says, on the beam, off the beam? I challenge you to find one of those things that are off the beam that ain't selfish. They're all selfish. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Fear is selfish. Anybody? Think of the last time you had a bunch of fear heaped on you. Right? Maybe it was about the job or the relationship or somebody sick. Well, maybe not somebody sick, but the job, something personal, right? What were you thinking about? You. I was thinking about me. I make horrible decisions based on fear. About my... Way back in the day, I thought this one girlfriend was cheating on me. Right? Just knew it. Knew it in my heart. It just tore me up. You know? Tore me up. Just knew she was cheating on me. So I went out with her best friend. Bad decision based on fear. Because she wasn't cheating on me. She retaliated. Bad decision based on self-seeking. Oh, I may do you a favor, but it ain't really a favor. I'm doing you a favor because maybe I'll think you'll like me better. Or I may do you a favor, but I'm going to hold that favor that I do for you in escrow to be collected at a later date. Self-seeking, self-pity, poor me. Next paragraph, he says, so our troubles we think are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. I didn't think so. Oh, I had chaos in my wake, and I'm like the guy coming up after the tornado. Look, it ain't blowing. It's great. You know? It's crazy. It says, now, I don't know about y'all. I'm sure y'all don't say that at this group, but I have all those hundreds and hundreds of AA meetings all over the place. They used to always tell me that there ain't no must in the big book. I'm going to read you two musts followed by a promise that'll kill you. So if anybody ever throws that at you, tell them to read the damn book. There's 67 of them in here. All right? But it says, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. There's two musts followed by a promise. I got to get rid of this selfishness. But guess what? I can't fix my selfishness. I can't do that. That's like throwing more me at the problem. I can't fix it. I got to have God's help. And they're going to go on to explain that, right? God's going to be my director. I'm just the actor. Right? God's going to be the father. I'm just the kid. The kid gets his instructions for his father. God's the principal. I'm the agent. The agent works for the principal. Right? Follows their lead. Some pretty good concepts of a higher power right there. This is some pretty cool stuff. In the middle of page 63, we got the third step prayer. And it says, it's very, very simple. It says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Exclamation point. So that's the third step prayer. Pretty simple. So I'm a few days sober, and I go over to my sponsor's house, and he'd give me stuff to read, and we sat down in his office at his house, and we went over in detail doctor's opinion and all that stuff again. And we went over and we talked about this higher power concept, this God thing. Do I got a problem? Do I got God stuck sideways in my craw, you know? Do I got anything that might be blocking me? So we talked about all that. And we read up to page 62, and we talked about all that. And he says, you ready to do the third step prayer? And I said, I'm ready to do anything. And he says, well, we'll see about that. And we said, come on, get your big book. And we went, got my big book, and we went into another part of his house, and he said we're going to his prayer bench, and looked like a little coffee table to me, but I didn't dare say anything to him. And we got down on our knees, and we opened our book to this page. And just like I'd done it in the previous attempts, we got on our knees and we opened the book to page 63 and we're getting ready to do a third step prayer. And I've done it before. It's the AA waltz. Step one, yeah. Step two, yeah. Step three, say the prayer, go get drunk. You know? Pretty simple. This guy is leading me on. And I mean, leading me to this point, you know, and I believed in what he said, you know, and I was willing to do whatever he said. And so we open the book to this page, and we get on our knees, and we put our arms around each other, and I still kind of got the shakes, because I'm a few days still off from my last drink. And I'm still kind of shaking a little bit, and we bowed our heads, and he says, before you do your third step prayer, I'm going to say a little something to God, make sure God's with us, and then you can do your prayer. And I said, all right. So I got my arms around him, and the old man starts to pray. I have no earthly idea what he said. Because in my head, I'm praying like my life depends on it. And I guess there was an uncomfortable pause when, you know, after I stopped praying, and I'm sitting there like a dope still praying in my head. And finally he nudges me and he says, I need to hear what you're saying to God. And this is my third step prayer. This is what I said. And I said, dear God, I've tried to get sober since 1988, and I'm scared. And I don't want to die drunk. I need your help. Please give me the willingness to do whatever I got to do to get what's in this book. Amen. And Clifford said, stand up. I thought I screwed up, you know. And I stood up and he gave me a hug and he says, you just did the third step prayer. See, I followed directions. I voiced it without any reservation. You know, I had no more lurking notions. It was either, this is going to work, or I was going to drink. No more bargaining chips. Well, they call it ego deflation. You know? from the bottom of my heart, I asked a supreme being for help, and I meant it. You look at the top of page 63, and this is some cool stuff. It says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. It's a promise. It says, we have a new employer. Being all-powerful, He provided what we needed if we kept close to Him and performed His work well. And the old man said, underline that sentence. He goes, there's your job description till the day you die. What's my job description? My job is to stay close to God and perform His work well. What does the book say that God's going to provide me? Everything I need. He says, John, if God's providing you everything you need, what else do you need? Nothing. He says, great. This is pretty simple, ain't it? I say, yeah. I've since added a little on to that. I don't want to rewrite the big book. This is what I tell my guys today. My job today is to stay close to God and perform His work well today, no matter what. That's my job. You know? That's my job. I got a purpose. It's to stay close to God and do this work, no matter what happens. If I do that, God provides me with everything I need. And if God's given me everything I need, I don't need anything else. I want a hell of a lot of things. I want so many things. You know? I want a fast car so I can get to the meetings faster. You know, I don't know. I want a lot of things, you know. But I got everything I need today. Everything I need. If you saw my bank account, you'd think, you're nuts. You know, my bank account is looking pretty slim today. But I can tell you from the bottom of my heart that I have everything that I need today. You know, I spent years and years and years trying to get out from where I was right at this moment, trying to get somewhere else. And I can be right here, right now, perfect peace and ease. I'm cool. I don't know what the hell is going to happen 10 minutes from now, but I'm okay right now, and that's good. And it says, let's read the rest of these promises. It says, established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. Me? A contributor? I spent all those years trying to suck everything I could out of you, out of my family, out of the meetings, right? And now they're telling me what I can contribute. What can I contribute? I asked my sponsor that. He says, get a dollar, get your big book, go to the 24-hour club, get a cup of coffee and talk to every son of a gun that walks in that door, stay there for a couple hours, call me when you get home. Click. Got something to offer. Didn't really know what that was, but I got something to offer, right? As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, there's a concept. As we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. We are reborn. He said, you get a big do-over. And you don't got to move. Just get a fresh start. You know? But I got a job to do. I just made a commitment with God. See, we spend a heck of a lot of time, or at least in from my ancient memories of what I used to hear in discussion meetings about, you know, step three is made a decision. We talk about the three frogs on a log and all that stuff. And that's all great stuff, right? All I've done in step three is I've made a commitment with my sponsor and the God of my understanding that I'm going to get off my rear end and take these actions. It's a commitment. When you were still back in your drinking days and you're sitting on your couch and you needed some beer, you made a decision to get beer. You made a commitment to go get beer. You didn't just think it, you thought it, and then you did it, right? Same thing with this. I make a commitment in step three with my sponsor that I'm going to follow these directions, right? I'm going to do whatever I got to do to get what they got. It's pretty specific. It's pretty plain. It's not all flowery. I ran into a guy at a treatment center the other day, and I kid you not, this is honest to God's truth. This guy is employed by a treatment center. And he says, if a man needs to work on his step three, his third step for a year, that's quite all right with us. And these people have a lot of alcoholics come through their place, and they got a boatload of crack addicts. And that crap like that is annihilating those men and women. The Big Book is very, very specific on how to take the steps, when to take the steps, with whom to take the steps. It gives me prayers and promises all along the way. If you got another idea, go do it. I don't care. But if you want what I got, we're going to do what they did. It's pretty simple. It was a very tedious process to get me to that point. But once I was there, there ain't no turning back. It says, we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, spiritual advisor. Who better to do my third step than my sponsor? He's been where I'm at. And he's where I want to get to. So he's going to hear my third step. He's going to be the judge, you know. Right? I had to tell you a little story about that. I've done boatloads of third step prayers since I've been sober. And they still blow me away. It's an awesome thing. You know? It's an awesome thing to hear. And most of the knuckleheads that I sponsor are guys that are just like me. Guys that have been in and out of treatment centers, in and out of AA groups all over the place. They've tried. They've got their butts kicked. They're desperate. They're dying. They're hopeless. And they hear us talk, and they see a little hope, and they get to this stuff. But I just talked to this cat today. It's a good friend of mine. He lives down in Austin now. He moved away a few months ago. And I'll never forget, he was at 24-Hour Club a couple years ago, and I do a meeting there every Sunday at 6 o'clock. Big Book study. And this guy came up after one of the meetings. It was just like his first Sunday night there. And he came up to me afterwards and he says, God, you've got to help me. He goes, I like what you had to say. You've got to help me. And we went outside and we talked for a little while and I found out all I could about him. And he'd been around AA. His brother's a, you know, pretty big speaker in his own right and goes around and he'd heard it, he'd tried it, and he'd, you know, been in the church, done everything under the sun. This guy was just hopeless. He had a Winnebago, an old Winnebago, not a nice one, like a real old-timey one. It was like beat. I mean, it was, we joke about it now, but it was trashy. And that's like parked in the 24-Hour Club parking lot. That's all he had in the world, right? Got a couple kids. His wife left him, and they just couldn't stand him. And this guy was living there. He had like a dollar to his name. And I started to work with him, and I gave him some stuff to read, told him I'd come up there to see him in a day or two, and da-da-da-da-da. Well, long story short, I come up a few days after that, after our first contact, and we went to this little coffee shop that's right by Baylor Hospital down there, and you get there in the afternoon, no one's in there, and we go way in the back so you're not bothered and everything, and we've each got a big book, and we start going through this information, because he had read some stuff, and I'm going through the doctor's opinion, and there's a solution, and more about alcoholism, and we agnostics, and we're going over this stuff that I just read. And he's asking questions along the way, and then he gets quiet, and I'm looking at my book, and I'm talking to him, and he looks up, and he's got tears rolling down his face. And he says, my God, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 15 years and nobody ever explained this stuff to me. Nobody. And that's how we did his third step prayer. We did it a couple minutes after that. That man's life changed like that. Like that. Had nothing to do with me. I just read the damn book. You know? But it's stuff like that I don't want to miss. You know? Another little third step story. I wasn't sober too long. I spent years and years and years of my other attempts at AA sitting on the back row trying to think of something witty to say so you'd like me. Right? Literally dying in Alcoholics Anonymous. Miserable. Right? So I get this little sponsor and we start going through the steps and my life changes like that. And I'm doing this work, and I'm at Homeward Bound listening to Myers and Kurt, and those guys do the meeting on Friday nights. And I'm like 3 weeks sober, right? Like my third Friday night to be at this little meeting. And I worked late that night. And I'm in and out outside all day long. It was kind of cool and kind of rainy, and I was starting to get a little cranky and my throat hurt and I had a headache. I didn't feel good. And I got home at like 7, the meeting's at 8 o'clock, and I'm thinking, man, I just need to take a shower and eat some soup and lay on the couch and relax so I don't get sick and everything. And I remembered, while I was taking a shower, I remembered that that Tuesday previous, I had met some guys from Homeward Bound, and I had talked to them, and I'd give them some little red books, and I asked them to read some stuff, and I told them that I'd be there Friday to work with them. And I mean, I'm like cursing myself in the shower, like, God, I don't feel good. Come on, God, I think I'm getting like the flu or something, Ebola or something, you know. It's bad. And I remember getting out of the shower, throwing on some clothes, putting on a hat, getting on my knees and asking God, say, God, please, I don't feel good. Make this hour go by quick so I can come home and rest so I don't get sick. And I left. And I went up to that meeting. And I get out of my car, and my buddy Kurt comes running up to me, and he goes, dude, I just got off the cell phone with Myers. They're coming in from Louisville. There's like an 18-wheeler jackknife. They're not going to make it. You and I got to do the meeting. And I said, man, I can't do the meeting. I've got to work with these two guys right here. And Kurt said, oh, my God. He goes, I got these three guys right here. And he says, I know what you can do. You sit down, you work with all five of these guys, and I'll go do the meeting. And I said, Kurt, I've done this one time before. He says, well, we better pray. And so Kurt said a little prayer, and he said, just do steps 1, 2, and 3 like we do. And I said, all right. And his guys were mean, man. They're like gangbangers. I mean, they were like mean and tall and kind of snarled and stuff. And I'm like, oh, my God. They didn't have a smile one. And we sat down, men who normally wouldn't mix, sat down, they all got big books, they all got them already started getting highlighted and stuff, and I opened my big book and I started to lay out steps 1, 2, and 3. And I did it in under an hour. And the hour's winding up, and we get to the part of the third step prayer, and I tell them how me and my sponsor had just done my third step prayer a couple weeks previous. And these guys that hour, these guys that normally wouldn't mix, that had a snarl, they're marking in their books, and they're and they're asking questions, and they're hook, line, and sinker. And they're the real deal. And I asked these guys, are y'all ready to do a third step prayer? And they said, you betcha. And I know y'all probably hadn't been to Homeward Bound, but the concrete is pretty filthy, cigarette butts everywhere. And these five guys plus me make six guys that normally wouldn't mix, got on our knees and put our arms around each other and bowed our heads. And I said a little prayer to make sure God was with us. And then to a man, it went around the horn. And each man did his third step prayer. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. We commenced a hugging. Cheerful. Little sparkles in their eyes. And I ain't telling you that story to brag. I'm telling you a story for one important reason. My job is to get off my rear and take this message to someone who is dying. Left to my own devices, I probably wouldn't have drank that night. I could have stayed home, taken a shower, had some soup, and gotten to bed and made it to my meeting the next night. The moral of that story is my job is to help drunks. My job is to get off my rear end and take a message of recovery to somebody who was dying just like I was. And for that, I got an experience that I'll never, ever forget. And it happens a lot. Thank you for having me.